Right, so let's remember what we did yesterday. So we discussed connections and covariant derivatives. And just to remind you, when you take the covariant derivative of some tensor, let's say it looks like this, I'm actually it's common to rewrite the covariant derivative in this way as a semicolon. Okay, remember the ordinary derivative, d alpha beta would just be a comma. And the way this is defined is by calculating the ordinary derivative and then adding a gamma factor for every upstairs index and subtracting a gamma factor for every downstairs index. I shall always put the derivative index last. That's a matter of convention. And it doesn't really matter if gamma is symmetrical. If there's no torsion, it doesn't really matter. And then you just contract all the remaining indices in the obvious way. Okay, so that's the definition of the covariant derivative. And now that we have a derivative which takes a tensor into a tensor, it makes sense to use that to construct new tensors. And in particular, yes?
Can you explain also the capital D notation that
you
use sometimes?
Yes.
Contraction with
something. Yeah, good. So we had something mu dx nu detour dx nu detour. Right, this was the equation that followed from the variational principle, also called a geodesic equation. And again, we found it that this connection appears in the geodesic equation, and so often we just write this as capital D by detour of dx alpha detour. This guy is fine because it's a four vector anyway. And that's of course the same as D by detour of U alpha. U alpha is the four velocity if tor is the proper time along the world line. But often we write this in order to indicate that this is a covariant derivative. Having taken the derivative, this is still a four vector. Right? So du alpha detour is not a four vector, but d by detour is a four vector. Okay, so in general, what would I mean? So it's a good question. What do I mean by that d by detour? Because in this case, I've got du alpha detour is equal to du alpha detour plus gamma alpha mu nu u mu u nu. Okay, where the u mu is the vector, is the tangent vector to the curve. I mean, there's the u alpha is dx alpha detour, right? So this is differentiation along some curve with tangent vector dx alpha detour, which is u alpha. What if I took some other vector, s mu, right? and I tried to differentiate S mu along this curve. Well, something's got to change, and obviously you want your derivative to be linear in whatever you're differentiating. So ds alpha detour along the same curve defined by x of tor or with tangent vector u alpha, this would be ds alpha detour plus gamma alpha mu nu u mu s nu. Okay, so in the covariant derivative along a curve, the velocity of the curve appears. Okay, and this quantity is a full vector.
So if you want to relate the covariant derivative like that with that, it's contracted with
the
u, right?
Yeah, now good question. What's the connection between this one and that one?
Yeah.
The connection is as follows. When you do, for example, fluid dynamics, there is the Lagrangian description where you describe it in terms of its particles or elements of the fluid. Okay, that would be relevant to this equation. There's also the Eulerian description where you say, no, u is a function of x. So you have a fixed set of coordinates x, and then at each x, there's some velocity. And you don't track the particles. You just say at each x, what is the velocity? So that kind of differentiation is obviously more relevant here. Now, the two things are completely equivalent, you can see, because if I form the covariant derivative of this guy, and then project it, and let's do this S to make it more general, right? So I've got some vector field, and then I differentiate along mu. Well, this is dx mu detour. So I take this and then evaluate it along the curve, right? And I will get this equation exactly. Okay, plus gamma alpha beta gamma. I'm just computing this guy here. This is the mu index. There's s beta. And then I've got, so this is the derivative. I contract it with the u. There's a u mu. And evaluate this on x on tor, right? So x equals x of tor. So that equation is exactly the same as this equation.
Shouldn't we have an s in the first term?
Sorry, that should be an s. Because what we have here is u mu is dx mu detour, and this is d by dx mu of s alpha of x, right? So just by the chain rule, this is exactly equivalent to taking ds detour. Okay, so these two things are completely equivalent. The particle description is the Lagrangian one, and the field description, which is what this is the Eulerian one. Yep.
Could you just make
it? Oh, sure. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. If not, then as I mentioned, we're going to work in this picture and use covariant differentiation to construct tensors essentially out of the metric, because we already saw that the metric, let's see, yeah, so We showed that locally you can always pick coordinates so that the first derivative of the metric is zero. And then there were these second derivative terms of the metric, which are the interesting ones. So somehow we want to construct a tensor out of second derivatives of the metric, which we hope will capture this, the second derivatives which cannot be set zero by coordinate transformations. So the way to do that is we consider the following object. Well, let's first do something simpler. Let's take the commutator of covariant derivatives on a scalar quantity. Okay. We know that the partial derivatives commute, but it's not clear these covariant derivatives commute. So we work that out. This means we have to calculate d mu, d nu s. You see, the covariant derivative acting on a scalar is just the partial derivative. There's no connection at all, right? Then you use a connection for each index. There are no indices, so there's no connection. So covariant derivative on a scalar is just ordinary derivative. And then I've got to reverse these two guys, so I have d mu s. And if I work that out, I need the connection. So this will give d mu s minus gamma mu nu alpha d alpha s. That's the first term. And then from the second term, I get d nu d mu s, and then plus gamma nu mu alpha d alpha s. These two obviously cancel. And what you see is that the coefficient of the derivative of s is nothing but the torsion, right? So this equals zero if T alpha mu nu equals zero. So with the zero torsion assumption, covariant derivatives commute on scalars. Okay. So to get something interesting in this case where the torsion is zero, we should try the next thing. So let's calculate d mu d nu on a vector. So now I have to do a little bit more algebra. And so what I do is just write this all out with the connections. The d nu on v rho gives me d nu v rho minus gamma rho nu sigma v sigma. And then I have to put the two connection terms in, gamma alpha nu mu d alpha v rho minus gamma sigma rho alpha v sigma minus gamma alpha rho mu d nu v alpha gamma alpha sigma alpha nu v sigma. Okay, so just to explain, this is the partial derivative of the covariant derivative of v, and then I have two connection terms with minus signs because this has two lower, that you're acting on an object with two lower indices. Okay, and then of course I've got to take everything here and subtract mu goes to nu, which is the reverse term in the commutator. Now, let's look at the terms which vanish. So somebody tell me which term obviously vanishes. All right, think about it. Which terms vanish?
The one that has derivatives.
There. Could you possibly take these two?
Yeah, he is. And that's the library. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So tell me a term which obviously vanishes.
The cross derivative, yeah.
What's that? First one. Yeah, this one is going to cancel because these are symmetric under mu goes nu. So when I subtract off the version with mu goes to nu, it will vanish, right? Now let's look at the next term in derivatives. Let's look at this term. Okay, is that going to vanish when I subtract off mu goes to nu? Why? Yes, so this one is going to vanish. Right? And, okay, so what about this one?
In the next one, there's also...
Oh, sorry, yes, the whole thing will vanish. That's right, the whole thing will vanish. Okay, because this is symmetric under mu goes to mu. Now, let's look at the term which involves the derivative of v. Okay, is that going to vanish? So this derivative is going to act either on the gamma or on the v. So let's look at the derivative of the v term. Is that going to vanish?
These gammas, are they like a bunch of numbers or do they depend on x?
They do all depend on x. Everything depends on x.
Because then you can like write out the first thing that's left there.
Yeah, remember the gamma here.
In two parts, taking the derivative of gamma and then multiplying by v, and taking the derivative of v and multiplying by gamma. And the second one is going to drop with that thing.
With which thing?
With the one with last term.
With this one. So this term, so if I differentiate this one, right? And then let's look at this guy. Right, this involves the derivative of v. This would be d mu v sigma. This would be d nu v sigma. Alpha here is essentially the same as sigma, right? Because they're just repeated indices. And this one has a plus, this one. Did I get the sign right? That's correct. So, you see, these two terms only differ by exchanging mu with nu, right? Derivative on this one is the same as this one with mu exchanged with nu. And they both have minus signs. So what that means is that this combination is symmetric under mu goes to nu. That's what it is. It's a single term with mu flipped to nu. Therefore, it will cancel when you subtract off mu goes to nu. Okay? Cancels. So that's very, very important because it means that even though we had two derivatives acting on the v, actually the answer does not depend on derivatives of v. The answer is just something times v. No derivatives of v. Okay, so this is equal to minus d mu gamma sigma rho nu. That's coming from this term. And then we have plus a gamma gamma term, gamma alpha v nu mu gamma sigma rho alpha times v sigma. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have taken this one. I mean this one. This one is gone. It's plus gamma alpha rho mu. Right? This one times that one. Sigma alpha nu b sigma. Okay? And then with the minus mu goes to mu. And this, by definition, we're going to call the negative of the Riemann tensor, sigma rho mu nu times v sigma. Okay, so if I write that out, let me try and push these up. Okay, so this is a tensor called the Riemann tensor.
In what part?
Sorry?
In what part have we convinced ourselves that it's a tensor? Because we
right. Okay, so if we convince ourselves that the covariant derivative
yeah.
of a vector is a tensor,
yeah.
and the covariant derivative of a tensor is still a tensor,
yeah.
then at least this is a tensor, right? It's a tensor for any v, right? For all v. This is a tensor for all v, right? And I mentioned last time the quotient theorem. If something, so it's something times v. If something times v is a tensor for all v, then the something is a tensor. Okay. So this is a tensor. This is by the quotient theorem. It's easy to prove the quotient theorem. I'll leave that to you. The coefficient must be a tensor. Okay, so I guess Riemann was pretty happy to discover this. And just to emphasize, the gamma is somewhat ugly thing. A gamma is not a tensor. I mean, it cannot be a tensor. It's there specifically to cancel bad terms. So it has to be a bad thing. But this derivative of gamma is a tensor. Now, let's look at it a little bit more closely. And let's begin by looking at its symmetries. Now, by definition, you could see that it's antisymmetric under the last two indices. This guy's antisymmetric under mu goes to nu. So R is obviously antisymmetric under mu goes to nu. That's how we constructed it. But it has a lot more symmetries. And to see these symmetries, let's choose a coordinate system at a point, or in a neighborhood of a point, such that the derivatives of the metric equals zero at that point. Okay, this is just to save ourselves a little bit of algebra. use the fact we can always pick coordinates at any given point. We can pick coordinates such that the derivatives of the metric vanish at that point. It follows that the connection equals 0 at the point. And so you can drop the last two terms. Now, what about the first terms? Well, remember gamma, we just have to remember this formula for gamma sigma rho nu. So that's 1 half g sigma lambda g rho lambda comma nu plus g nu lambda comma rho minus g rho nu comma lambda. Okay, when you've played around with GR enough, this formula will become second nature. It's a bit horrible in the beginning. But now let's calculate the mu derivative of this. And we can use the fact that the derivative of the metric is 0. So the first thing I've got to do is differentiate this G with upstairs indices. Okay, that's a little tricky. So what is d mu of g alpha beta? Any ideas? Okay, so I know that, let's try to express this in terms of those derivatives of g with lower indices. Now the one thing you know is that the upstairs guy times the downstairs guy is the Kronecker delta, right? Because by definition, the upstairs guy is the inverse. So what I can do is just differentiate this equation with respect to mu, and I get d mu g alpha beta times g beta delta plus g alpha beta d mu g beta delta equals 0, right? And now I can just multiply by the inverse of this matrix. So let's multiply by the G with upstairs to remove this factor. So I'm just going to remove that and multiply with G delta gamma. And now this index becomes gamma. And so the derivative of G with upstairs indices is equal to minus G inverse the derivative of G with downstairs indices times G with an upstairs index. And I better change this to a gamma so my indices don't get confused. The derivative of G upstairs indices is the negative of G inverse derivative of G, G. So obviously, if the derivative of G vanishes at a point, then the derivative of G with upstairs will also vanish at the point. And so we can write d mu gamma sigma rho nu equals, so in these coordinates, is equal to 1 half g sigma lambda g rho lambda comma nu nu mu plus g nu lambda comma rho mu, just put a mu on the last index, rho nu comma lambda mu, and the other term d nu gamma sigma rho mu, I just replace the mu with nu, g sigma lambda g rho lambda comma mu nu plus g mu lambda comma rho nu minus g rho mu comma lambda nu. And so then to get the Riemann tensor, I can ignore all these terms, just subtract the second thing from the first thing. Obviously, these two will cancel. And so I'll get that the Riemann tensor, sigma rho mu nu, check up that all my indices right, is 1/2 g sigma lambda g nu sigma comma rho, sorry, g nu lambda comma rho mu minus g rho nu comma lambda mu minus g nu lambda comma rho nu plus g rho mu comma lambda mu. Okay, so I just took these two terms and these two terms and subtracted. Lowering, if we just lower the sigma index, R sigma rho mu nu is 1/2 g nu sigma comma rho mu minus g rho nu comma sigma mu minus g mu sigma comma rho nu plus g rho mu comma sigma mu. Okay, so in a particular coordinate system where I can ignore first derivatives of the metric, this is the expression for the Riemann tensor in terms of second derivatives of the metric. Now let's understand its symmetries. First of all, just the obvious point that if a tensor has some symmetries in a particular coordinate system, then it has to have exactly the same symmetries in any coordinate system, right? Why? Because to get it in any coordinate system, all I'm going to do is multiply by the Jacobian matrices, and they won't change the symmetry properties at all. Flipping indices, every index you're just attaching a Jacobian matrix to and doesn't change anything. So the symmetry, so you can, if you can see the symmetries of a tensor in a particular coordinate system, then you've understood them in all, those symmetries are valid in all coordinate systems. So now one of these symmetries is already obvious from the original definition, exchanging mu with nu, right? It should be anti-symmetric under exchanging mu with nu, and let's just check that. If I exchange mu with nu, this term goes to this term, right? Exchanging mu with nu, I get this term, and this term with mu goes to nu goes to that term. But there's a lot more symmetry in this expression, which is, so let's start with that one. It's anti-symmetric under mu goes to nu. Well, what if it's natural to ask, what about the other two indices, sigma and rho? What happens if I flip sigma and rho? Does it have any symmetry? So if I flip sigma and rho, this term goes to that term, right? Sigma and rho, this becomes nu rho, but g is symmetric under nu and rho. And the second derivatives are also symmetric under these two indices. Okay, so flipping sigma with rho this term goes to that, so it's anti-symmetric. This term, sigma with rho, this term goes to that, right? So the tensor is anti-symmetric under exchanging the first two indices or the second two indices. It's symmetric under exchanging the pairs of indices. So let's write that as sigma rho goes to mu nu. Right? So if I flip sigma rho with mu nu, what does that mean? Replace sigma with mu and rho with nu, right? And vice versa. So sigma with mu, rho with nu, nu with rho, and mu with sigma. Okay, so this term goes to that one, which is over there. All right, so I get a plus sign. So it is symmetric under this. It's symmetric under flipping the first pair of indices with the second pair of indices. And third, it is cyclic on the last three indices. Okay, so what does that mean? It means you write down the Riemann tensor with all indices lowered, and cyclicity means that I'm going to cycle these indices around and add them. So I leave the first index alone, but I'm going to put mu in the second index and flip rho round to the last, and then I'm going to shuffle nu to the second index and mu round to the last. And the claim is that this equation is true. Okay. Now, this isn't a total surprise. You might say it's just a fluke, but it isn't really a fluke. This is a result of the result of a very general identity always used in algebra involving three objects. What's that identity?
Jacobi.
Almost.
Jacobi,
yeah. It's a result of the Jacobi identity, which is, you see, that this, we use the commutator of a derivative, but let me just think if this is actually true. I'm not sure this is true.
To use the Jacobi identity,
you need another derivative. Yeah, I don't think that's actually true. Okay, it is true algebraically. The Jacobi identity does involve something like this, which involves d rho, d mu, d nu, right, equals zero for any, sorry, plus cycles. This is true just by writing out the brackets, okay, for any objects which are, I guess, associative. But so maybe it's not a total surprise, but it is true of this object. Just algebraically, if you add these terms, you'll find everything cancels. So, question. How many independent components do we have? Does R sigma rho mu nu have? So, for the first property, we see it makes sense to think of these two as indices. Okay, so if I think of the first pair as an index, because it's anti-symmetric under those two, so each pair, so the first regard the first and second, first and second pair of indices, as indices. Okay, so then the Riemann tensor has two indices. Each one can take the number of values corresponding to an anti-symmetric 4x4 object. Okay, so R and by 1 and 2, the Riemann tensor is like a symmetric matrix with d minus 1 over 2 let's say in dimension with dimension. Okay, so it's like a symmetric matrix with two indices, each one of which can take this many values. And so it has dd minus 1 over 2 times dd minus 1 over 2 plus 1, all multiplied by a half, independent components. Okay, so that's taking into account the first two symmetries. We still have to take account the third symmetry. And so the cyclicity equation is totally anti-symmetric. Okay, so let us just check that under exchange of any two indices. Okay, so to check that, let's exchange rho with sigma, for example. So now I get R rho sigma mu nu plus R rho mu nu sigma plus R rho nu sigma mu. And the claim is that this quantity is the negative of the original. Okay? So obviously this term, that's trivial because this is sigma rho mu nu with a minus sign. The next term, so this rho mu, let's see, I can, if I flip this pair of indices with that pair of indices, this will give R nu sigma rho mu. It's not quite the same as this term because it has these indices flipped. So this is equal to minus R nu sigma rho mu. And the last term, rho nu, I can flip this pair of indices. So this is using property 2, R sigma mu rho nu. And then
you flipped the left.
Sorry, I wrote this wrong, didn't I? This should be sigma nu I'm trying to identify it with this one. The last indices are in the wrong order. So this is minus sigma mu nu rho. Okay, so I showed that by flipping sigma with rho, this left-hand side is equal to minus itself, just using properties 1 and 2. Okay? So you can check that in general, that the cyclicity equation is totally antisymmetric. And so it provides only 1 over 4 factorial, a totally antisymmetric object with 4 indices, each taking d values. It has this many independent components. Okay, so whatever I take for the first index, I have to take a different second index, I have to take a different third index, and a different fourth index. And then all the permutations just differ by minus signs, so I divide by 1 over factorial. So it provides only this many equations. Okay, so the number of independent components of the Riemann tensor of R mu nu rho sigma, taking 1, 2, and 3 into account, are one-eighth d, well, the first formula here, one-eighth d minus 1 d squared minus d plus 2 minus 1 over 4 factorial d minus 1 d minus 2 d minus 3. And now is the magic moment. That just doing that algebra, you find the number of components you have is exactly this. And if you remember, this is exactly the number of second derivatives of G of G, which G alpha beta, the metric, which cannot be set zero, be set zero by a coordinate transformation. Okay, so at this point, Riemann must really have been very pleased that he had succeeded in characterizing all the second derivatives of the metric, which can't be set zero, in terms of a tensor. So this Riemann tensor really measures the curvature of the space, where by curvature, this is exactly what I mean, the second derivatives of the metric, which cannot be set zero. Yeah.
So how do you know that these are all the symmetries of the tensor?
You don't. yes, there is a, I mean, I think you could, you presumably you can do examples to convince yourself there's nothing else. Yes, this is a shortcut argument for sure, and it's not it's not a proof. It's a plausibility argument, at best. That's what it is.
I just have a question about, do you remember when you said that if something has symmetries in one coordinate system,
yes,
it has them in all?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we only showed that this has symmetries at the origin of this coordinate system?
Yes, but that is true of any point. So you see, if all I want to show is symmetries, I'm not going to differentiate anything. So just pick any point,
choose the coordinates at that point, and I can do the same argument holds at any point. Okay, so as long as you're not differentiating, it's always fine to just treat any point as the origin. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a very important thing, the Riemann tensor. It's a foundation of GR.
New?
Yes, go ahead.
You're right that it comes from the Jacobi identity.
Sorry?
It is coming from the Jacobi identity. If you add the Jacobi identity on the scalar, then equals zero, because you just showed that the commutator act on scalar is zero, and the other one gives you Riemann tensor, and then you cyclic. So
yes, I guess that's true on any scalar. Okay, good. So thanks. Okay, so this equation you're saying follows from, well, let's see. What you're saying is that if I do this, acting on a scalar, right, for any scalar, that must be true. And then what you'll get out of this is this multiplied by the derivative of the scalar, I presume. That's the way it works, something like that, right? That this times g sigma alpha d alpha s equals zero, right? And that's true for all scalars. So yeah, I think in particular, I could pick a scalar to be one of the coordinates. And so when I differentiate, I just get constant, which I can pick in any direction. And I can pick different scalars and basically then argue that this is true. Good. OK, thanks. So this is the Jacobi identity. OK, so it's not really a surprise, the cyclicity property. Okay, so we have this tensor, the Riemann tensor, and we can construct various relatives of it, and we will see that GR is entirely formulated in terms of the Riemann tensor and its relatives.
Can you raise that board?
The one behind?
The one on the left.
Just oh, sorry. That sorry. Area. Yeah, yeah. So relatives of Riemann . So obviously if I have a tensor, I can contract two of its indices, and that still gives me a tensor. So if I write this, that's still a tensor. You see, the Riemann tensor is anti-symmetric on the first two and the last two indices, so you can't contract those. If I contract those, for example, if I try to do this, g mu nu r mu nu rho sigma, this is zero, because this is symmetric and that's anti-symmetric. So you cannot contract the first two or the last two indices to get a tensor, but you can contract the first and the third. That's no problem. Or the first and the fourth, but that would be equivalent to the first and the third because of the anti-symmetry under permuting the third and the fourth. OK, so this is called the Ricci tensor. So I guess Richie was pretty lucky, because he really didn't do anything at all in this context. He did lots of other great things. But poor guy got his name on this tensor for really not doing anything at all, contracting Riemann with the metric. I hope he didn't get any prizes for that. And then he even got another thing, too, which is the Ricci scalar. G nu rho, this OK. You see, it should be fairly obvious that the Ricci tensor is symmetric under nu and rho. Because if I flip these pairs of indices, right, this becomes R sigma rho sigma nu, right? And it's symmetric under flipping pairs of indices. And if I now put this one up and this one down, that doesn't change anything. And so that's Riemann with the reversed indices. So Ricci with the reversed indices. So this is symmetric under nu goes to rho. And because of that, I can contract it again with the metric. And this is called the Ricci scalar. So he got doubly lucky without really doing anything. So in fact, R is the unique, I'm going to get in trouble, R is the unique scalar which involves only two derivatives of the metric, and that language I'll clarify a little bit. It'll spell out in what sense I mean it's unique. And is used to form the action of general relativity S is proportional to integral over spacetime d4x. We want an action which integrates over all spacetime. We need to make this volume element into a something which is invariant under coordinate transformations. The way to do that turns out to be this. This is invariant under coordinate transformations. I'll show that in a little while. And then we just multiply it by R. Okay, so this is the only action you can write down which is a function of the metric and involves only two derivatives of the metric. Okay, because the Ricci scalar involves two derivatives of the metric. If I tried to write down an action which did not involve any derivatives of the metric, okay, there's also a unique one. So this involves two derivatives of the metric. So let me say, what's a better language? Let's say it's second order in derivatives. In derivatives. Okay? Compared to a free particle is x dot squared in the action. If you have only two derivatives in the action, which you have for a free particle, generalizing that to GR, if we only allow two derivatives in the metric, we would get this one. There is actually another term, which Einstein also invented, which would be So there is a term. There is a term with no derivatives. Okay, and that is the d4x root g root minus g lambda, where this is the cosmological constant or dark energy. Dark energy. And this also is absolutely unique. In fact, that if you want to write down an action for a metric which involves no derivatives at all, that's the only thing you can write down. So these two actions, both of which are part of the world, both describe the world. This one describes gravity. This one describes the dark energy, exist in nature. Now, let me talk a little bit about generalizations. A lot of people, it's not difficult to generalize this. If I'm happy to have higher, more derivatives in the action, I can introduce more things. Okay, for example, I could write down R squared. This would involve second derivatives of the metric in R squared. So in this terminology, it would involve four derivatives of the metric. Okay, or I can write down things like Riemann squared, R mu nu rho lambda. That's also scalar. Again, it involves four derivatives of the metric. And there are a large number of such terms, in fact, an infinite number. You can keep contracting Riemann with itself until you're blue in the face. You can take derivatives of the Riemann tensor. I could write down this. Well, this would be an ordinary derivative, right? That's a vector g alpha lambda. You can do all this kind of stuff, but it involves more derivatives. And string theory does indeed introduce lots and lots of such terms, which are, there's a general argument that at low energies, a bit similar to what I argued for the particle coupling to electromagnetism, at low energies, these higher derivative terms should be unimportant. So these two terms are the dominant ones at low energies.
Neil?
Yeah.
Do we give any physical interpretation to, for example, a third or third derivative of the metric? Like with the second, we talk about curvature.
Right.
And we can imagine that physically.
Right.
With third, higher orders?
Change in the curvature?
Change in the curvature. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if there's any natural interpretation. There's quite a lot to play with the Riemann tensor. So let's do a little more with the Riemann tensor. I'm not sure about the derivatives. So while we're talking about tensors, I think I'll mention one more. Actually, I will just leave this to you to do. So an exercise, prove that root minus g d4x is coordinate invariant. Okay, where G here, by definition, G is the determinant of the matrix G alpha beta, regarded as a 4x4 symmetric matrix. Okay, so I'll just leave that as an exercise. Now, another interesting tensor is the Weyl tensor. And this is constructed from the Riemann tensor as follows. But basically you just take the Riemann tensor and subtract out all the contractions of it. So the defining property of Weyl will be that any contraction of the Weyl tensor is zero, okay, by construction.
So how do I do that?
Well, I'll add these terms. G, let me just check I've got the indices right. Indices are wrong in the notes. Apologies. I think sigma should be lambda. G nu rho r mu lambda. G nu sigma r rho mu. G mu rho r nu lambda. Let me just write it down and then we'll discuss it a little bit. Okay, so all you're doing here is just adding linear combinations of the metric and the Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar. And these combinations are designed. These are designed to ensure that all contractions of C, mu nu rho lambda, vanish. Okay, so you can easily check that, for example, if I tried to play the same trick I did with Riemann of contracting mu with rho, right? Here I'm going to get Ricci tensor, but now I'm contracting mu with rho. So in some places, you see contracting mu with rho is just going to convert this into a Ricci. And the same here. Over here, I'm going to, when I contract G mu rho, G mu rho, that's going to give D, a factor of D. And so all these factors of D will come in. Likewise here, I'll get D. And these terms are just designed to cancel off everything. So C has the same symmetries as Riemann. So it has the same symmetries as Riemann and no contractions. Now, actually, the reason the Weyl tensor is so interesting is that if you take pure gravity, so as we shall see, for pure gravity, and what do I mean by that? I mean gravity in the absence of any matter. So there's no matter at all. I just have space-time. For pure gravity, the Einstein field equation. So pure gravity means no matter, or even lambda. I don't even want any vacuum energy, just space-time being free to bend. The Einstein field equation reads R mu nu equals zero. The Ricci tensor is zero. And what that means is that the Riemann tensor is the Weyl tensor. Okay. So when you see pictures of black holes or gravitational waves or whatever you see, the only non-zero thing in those pictures is the Weyl tensor. So Weyl tensor captures. So in this case, the Weyl tensor describes all the all the degrees of freedom in pure gravity. It's not hard to show the number of components of the Weyl tensor, which are fewer than the Riemann tensor. Okay, so the number of independent components well, I just take the Riemann tensor and I take out all the traces. Okay? So the number of independent components is equal to the number of components of the Riemann tensor minus the constraint. So what is the constraint we have? The constraint is just that C lambda mu lambda nu equals 0. The trace should be 0. This is a symmetric two-index matrix in d dimensions. So this equation is a constraint on the Weyl tensor. And this equals this many components, just the number of components of a symmetric matrix in d dimensions. And so this is equal to 1/12 d plus 1, d plus 2, d minus 3 components. Sorry, did I get that right? Yes, that's right. So,
are these those that would correspond to the degrees of freedom in the energy momentum?
No, this is when energy momentum is zero.
Zero, so but yes. These are the lost degrees of freedom.
These are the degrees of freedom which remain in gravity when there is no matter around. Just pure gravity.
Sorry, I meant the difference.
Well, this is the number of components of the Weyl tensor.
Yes.
And that describes how many degrees of freedom in pure gravity.
But the difference is lost by taking the energy momentum tensor to zero.
This
is also.
Yeah, that's a coincidence. I mean, this. Let me think. I don't think it's as simple as that. I'm only imposing this condition. This condition, so I take a tensor with all the symmetries, 1, 2, 3, and furthermore, I insist on this equation. And that gives me this guy. So I'm not talking about matter at all. I'm just talking about the Weyl tensor, the definition of the Weyl tensor. And it leaves you with this many independent components. The thing to notice is that this is negative if d is smaller than 3. So d equals 1 or 2. So that just tells you something went wrong in your calculation. Okay, so if d equals 1, there are no components of the Riemann tensor. So what are you doing subtracting out traces and so on? If d equals 2, in d equals 2, the Weyl tensor is zero, it turns out, is exactly zero. And so the Riemann that means that in two dimensions, the Riemann tensor can be expressed entirely in terms of the Ricci tensor and scalar. So d equals 1, r equals 0, r mu nu rho lambda equals 0, d equals 2, Weyl tensor is 0 identically. And so that gives you a nice identity. You don't need to worry about the Riemann tensor anymore. You can just use the Ricci tensor in two dimensions. In d equals 3, in D equals 3, there is, okay, so let me just think what happens in D equals 3. Oh, yeah, sorry. I said it slightly wrong. Indeed, this is true, of course. Yeah, in D equals 2, what happens is the only non-trivial component, the only non-trivial, well, let's see. Everything can be expressed. Yeah, let me say it this way. Curvature can be expressed in terms of R. Can be expressed in terms of R. One way to say that, in D equals 2, there's only one independent component of the Ricci, of the Riemann tensor. I don't know where we wrote that down, but if you check the formula, well, I guess it's here, right? So D equals 2, this is 4 times 3 over 12, so there's only one component. That one component is the Ricci scalar. So in two dimensions, everything can be expressed in terms of the Ricci scalar. In D equals 3.
And does the Weyl tensor vanish in D equals 2?
Well, you see, this formula doesn't make any sense, D equals 2, because you're dividing by infinite by 0. So don't use this formula in D equals 2. Okay. In D equals 3, the curvature can be expressed purely in terms of, yeah, so in D equals 3, the Weyl tensor vanishes, and the curvature can be expressed in R mu nu, in the Ricci tensor, just using this equation with C equals 0. So 4D is the first time the Weyl tensor becomes interesting. And the number of degrees of freedom in three-dimensional gravity without any matter is 0. There are no gravitational waves in three dimensions. Okay, it's only when we get to four dimensions that we get interesting dynamics in pure gravity. Some other little theorems. Some interesting theorems. So if the Riemann tensor is 0, and for it to be 0, it only needs to be 0 in one coordinate system, because then it's automatically 0 in all coordinate system. So if the Riemann tensor is 0, this implies that the metric is the Minkowski metric in some coordinates. Or let's say it, there exist coordinates in which G mu nu is eta mu nu. Okay, so space-time being flat is exactly equivalent to the Riemann tensor being 0. Of course, you can always take flat space and write it in some disgusting coordinates, and then the metric looks a big mess, but that doesn't mean anything. It just means you've picked some ugly coordinates. If the Weyl tensor is 0, this implies, and is implied by, G mu nu equals a scalar function times eta mu nu. So we call this conformally flat. So there exist coordinates in which G is this, i.e., the metric is conformally flat. this is the called the conformal factor. Okay.
So the gravitational waves are conformal deformations.
No. No, because you can see that from here. The gravitational waves are the part of C that's not zero. Gravitational waves are C. Yeah, other way around. C measures the gravitational waves. Okay, so now there's a very interesting fact about the physical fact. The early universe was conformally, well, nearly conformally flat. Okay, so Roger Penrose has proposed C equals zero as a boundary condition on the early universe. Here's the Big Bang. Big Bang. And C equals zero. This is called the vanishing veil curvature hypothesis, that somehow the universe started off in this conformally flat state. And it's certainly a very interesting proposal. Which is being explored in many ways.
And why did you put nearly?
Sorry?
Why did you put nearly?
Well, because we don't know. Okay. We have lots of measurements. Some of them are, well, yeah, let me think. Why did I say nearly? Let me say it this way. The Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, which to very good accuracy describes the background universe, right? Not the perturbations. The Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, which describes the background universe, is exactly conformally flat. Okay, so this is conformally flat. So this now, the early universe was almost perfectly Friedman-Robertson-Walker, but it has some perturbations in it as well. And those perturbations, at linear order, would not, the matter perturbations would not affect the Weyl curvature. Okay, it would only be the gravitational waves, but they would occur at second order. So when you have scalar perturbations, they actually generate tensor perturbations at second order. So the fact is that there is some approximation in which this is true, but I think the details still are not clear. And I hope, you know, the work I'm doing will eventually shed light on this. We just published a paper on resolving the Big Bang singularity in the case when the matter is conformally invariant, and this is certainly related to this hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. What was the motivation of Roger Penrose for
postulating this? What was the motivation? It's basically this fact. So he's cheating, like all good physicists. He's looking at the answer. The universe, for some very peculiar reason, emerged from a singularity in this almost homogeneous isotropic state. And then you say, what's special about that metric? Well, it's conformally flat. So he's trying to, I think that was the main motivation. He also believed some initial condition is necessary in the universe for thermodynamic reasons. You know, why is there an arrow of time? You've got to somehow specify a starting point which is very ordered for the universe, and then disorder should grow over time. So again, you want to look at Einstein's theory. Einstein's theory sheds no light on this at all because it's a time reversal invariant. So he wanted some condition which is which distinguishes the beginning from the future. and that's the one he suggested. Yeah, he's written many books about this. I don't think you'll find any greater justification, though, than just that partly it matches the observations, partly it's needed for thermodynamics. Yeah.
So if you can assume that there's conformal invariance in the beginning, and it gets spontaneously broken somehow.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly the idea. We're still working on it. So you have to treat it quantum mechanically. So our paper describes the evolution of a quantum universe with conformal invariant matter, and we give an exact solution. So it's quite surprising. So yeah, eventually this will explain the universe without inflation, but we'll see. We're not there yet. Okay, I think I'd better end there. So next time, don't miss tomorrow's lecture, because we're going to do the Einstein equations tomorrow and the day after. These are the most fundamental equations in physics. But let me also advertise, today we have a wonderful colloquium. What's the name of the speaker? It's a friend of mine. This is embarrassing. I don't mind. I don't claim to have a good memory. So he gives. I know him, not his name.
It's like Müller or something, right?
Müller. That's it. Holger Müller. He's from Berkeley, and the reason this is so exciting is that you probably know that quantum technologies are really growing extremely rapidly these days. In particular, the sensitivity with which you can measure things is becoming astronomical. Okay, so for example, the advanced LIGO detector, the current one, measures the length of the arms of their gravitational wave detectors, which are 4 kilometers, and they measure that length to an accuracy better than 1/10,000th the size of an atomic nucleus. Okay, they're measuring plus or minus 1/10,000th of a Fermi.
It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. So the way they are doing that is by exploiting quantum effects, and they are working at the quantum noise limit and then using clever tricks to overcome even quantum noise. I mean, literally, the quantum uncertainty in the position of a 20-kilogram mirror, right, is equal to the sensitivity of their experiment. Okay, they are dealing with the quantum mechanical uncertainty in the position of an object 20 kilograms heavy. Okay, anyway, this is what is happening with quantum technologies. Holger is a world expert on doing precision quantum experiments. I think there's some similar numbers. You know, when you press the key on your laptop, that gives you roughly, I think that force is about a newton. Maybe it's a hundredth of a newton. Anyway, they can measure forces now to an accuracy, I think 10 to the minus 17 of that force you exert on your laptop. We can measure times to an accuracy of 1 second, better than 1 second in the age of the universe. All right, the universe is about 10 to the 17 seconds old, and time is now measurable to accuracy of 10 to the minus 17. So these quantum measurements are becoming extremely powerful, and many people believe that actually the new frontier for experimental physics is not the high energy frontier, it's the precision frontier. The astonishing thing is there doesn't seem to be a fundamental limit. So if you ask these people who work on gravitational wave detectors, you know, okay, now you can do, well, LIGO is doing 10 to the minus 21 in length. You ask them, what's the ultimate limit? And nobody knows of any ultimate limit. So it could go down to 10 to the minus 30. I'll tell you more about this when we discuss cosmology, because basically this means we're going to have microscopes which will look right back to the Big Bang and see the Planck time. Okay, there's nothing we know of to prevent us actually seeing what happened at the Big Bang. It's extremely interesting and exciting. Anyway, Holger is on the forefront of this use of quantum precision measurement to test fundamental physical theories. And so it'll be a really exciting talk.
He's going to talk about search for dark energy?
Yes. So dark energy, as I explained, is actually the simplest kind of energy you can imagine. It's constant in space, in time. It's Lorentz invariant. It's a weird kind of energy that just doesn't change no matter what you do. That's really hard to look for. The only way we know to look for dark energy is to use the biggest volume we can. You see, its only effect, real dark energy, in other words, this lambda, doesn't enter physics at all apart from through gravity, right? So when you do an experiment, you've got some energy in the room, dark energy in the room before and after, and it doesn't change. Nothing you can do to change it. So it actually cancels in all physical processes, except gravity, because gravity really measures the whole energy. So the best way we have to measure the dark energy is take the biggest volume we have, so it has the most possible dark energy, and measure the change in that volume. And that's what we do. We measure the expansion rate of the universe in various ways, and that's how the dark energy was detected, right? But if you try to do it in the lab, that kind of dark energy doesn't do anything. So people postulate, well, maybe the dark energy is a bit more interesting. Maybe actually it's the value of a field which can change. And so the value of lambda is not a constant. It can be a function of space-time. And that's the kind of dark energy that Holger can test. And he's managed to disprove various proposals. One of them was called a chameleon. There's a field which can hide itself because it's called a chameleon. So it looks like dark energy, but actually it's a field. It can change. And he's managed to disprove that hypothesis. So that's really very, very interesting. I think there must be about 10,000 papers on different models for the dark energy. Okay. The simple one was written by Einstein in 1917, and it describes everything we know to exquisite precision. But you know, recently, what do we do? You can't write a paper about that one. It's too simple. So people embellish, and they invent models and fields and blah, 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 and then they try to disprove them. And nobody has come up with a better model of the dark energy. Not to say we understand it. That is probably the biggest problem in fundamental physics. What is the value of that lambda that I wrote down? What is its value? We calculate it in quantum field theory, and we get it completely wrong. We know quantum field theory is wrong. Okay, when we couple it to gravity, it is wrong. And yet it's what everyone in this building does all the time. We know it's wrong. Okay, this is fantastic. This is your chance. Okay, find out what we're doing wrong. It's very important. We know the dark energy is there, but it is not what we calculate in quantum field theory. I may talk more about that next week. But don't start me, because then I will not leave this room. Any other questions? No? OK, see you tomorrow.